All right, you should have gotten a handout this morning. And it has two pages stapled together, correct? The one that has I think it's on the second page, it's got the gray and white bars on it. That's one that you, during the study, you may want to just tear off, stick in the back of your Bible as we're going along, because it has these major events, and then it's got some dates on there for you to be able to follow along through the story of the Old Testament. So we're not going to be looking at that today, but if you want to put that in your Bible, it might be very helpful to keep handy as we're doing our study. All right, Genesis. I'm hoping during this study that I'll finish some of these. I've written about 10 or 12 of these little summaries of these Old Testament books. I did this probably 7 or 8 years ago, and then I dropped off. I intended to get the whole Old Testament and New Testament done, but I haven't yet. So I'm hoping that this is the impetus doing this Sunday school series that we'll be able to finish this. And if any of you has artistic abilities, you can draw some pictures, and maybe we'll put together a little kids book or something for it. So Genesis is the beginnings of the world and man and his sinnings. It tells of God's judgment and of God's love. The story is only beginning. God made everything good. Every man and woman who should obey him alone, but they followed the snake. Now death, Satan, sin hold the day. But God gives a promise of rescue to Eve and to Noah, and then to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but it's Jesus who will come to save them. So Genesis is the beginnings. Where would we be? What would we be missing if we didn't have Genesis chapters 1 through 11 in our Bibles? What would we be missing? What do you think? Historical context for Christ. Yes. The historical context for Christ. Yes. A glimpse of God's power. A glimpse of who God was from the beginning. Who he is. A rainbow would just be refracted light through water droplets. It wouldn't have significance, spiritual or theological significance.
We wouldn't know that God made everything perfect and that sin is the result. So everything else is the result of sin.
We wouldn't know that God made everything perfectly and that everything else is the result of sin. That's a big one, especially when you live in a secular age, coming out of an evolutionary mindset, but across philosophies throughout history, you see people trying to explain why we have sin, why we have evil, why we have pain, and Genesis 1 through 11 gives us a reason. It's not simply because the species are fighting against one another and some die out by natural selection, and that's just how it goes. It's because of sin. Yeah, very good. She said, isn't basically the whole of the redemption story contained in those 11 chapters? And we do. We get them kind of in a seedling form. You've got the holy God and you've got sin, but then you begin God's response to sin, the beginning of his plan to redeem mankind out of the pit that they've fallen into. And all of that's there in seedling form. His grace, his forgiveness, man's rebellion, not just in seedling form, that's there in full-fledged day, mature form. Another question here. When was the book of Genesis written? It's written by Moses. Now when does Moses live? And you could look on your little timeline here. Yes, sir. Yes, all those, yeah, good point. Josiah said that Moses wrote it down, but it seems like it's a compilation of accounts or stories. And that's very true. We shouldn't think that Moses was writing a story out of his head, certainly not that, and probably not even merely recording from different stories that he's heard from grandma and grandpa or from this or that, but that there probably were accounts that his compiling of it and composing of it, he was drawing from sources that were available to him. So she says that begs the question of who his sources were. What would that affect, or how would that? Did I see a hand over here? Yeah, we don't know who the sources were. We assume that they were at least passed down from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there were writings during that time. There were writings prior to Moses' life. He grew up in the courts of Egypt. And so if ever there was a place that there would be, that he would have access to any or all writings that were in that time period, that existed in that time period, he would have had access to those from various nations. Noah would have been one of the ones who was passing on the stories. And yes, we don't know how much was oral tradition, how much was written down. We don't know. That's lost to us. We don't have that information. We're not able to track the changes on Wikipedia article on what happened at the Tower of Babel. They're not footnoting anything for us. But what does that tell us? So if Moses is writing this 1500 BC and he's giving us a history from 4,000, 6,000 BC or whatever those dates are up until that time, why is it significant that Moses is recording that? And who is he writing it for? We'll start with that question. Who's Moses writing for? That's the easier one. He's writing for the Jews. They're coming out of Egypt as a nation, and he's writing for them. So what would his purpose in writing for them be? Yeah, and there's a couple lines there. Exactly. They need to understand who their God is, who their maker is, and what God has done in choosing them in choosing their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and what the purpose of choosing them for. What's the purpose of their existence? Well, and as we read through the book of Genesis, we learn God created everything good, man rebelled against him, but God has a plan to bring back his blessing to all the nations of the earth. And guess what, Israel? It is through you that those plans are going to be brought about. It's through you that God is going to do that for all the nations of the earth. And so that's a fundamental, a foundational part of who they are and why God has chosen them and what he's doing with them. They need to understand that God is their maker, the maker of heaven and earth, the rightful king who has chosen them to carry out his plan to bless the world. Turn over the page of the handout. On the back is an outline. You see the word there, toledoth. Toledoth is the word in Hebrew for generations. Generations. Now the book of Genesis is not a haphazard account. It's not a stringing together. It's not a scrapbook of, well, this story happened and this story happened and this story happened and this story happened. You know, some of you mothers or parents and may make a scrapbook for your kids. And then they've got it at graduation day or at their wedding or something, and everyone can go thumb through. And it's not necessarily meant to be an organized account of the child's life. It's just a smattering of memories and fun events and family events. The book of Genesis, it's not put together in a haphazard fashion like that. It's a very organized book. And in fact, as we go through this series, I hope one of the things that you'll see is all of the scriptures tend to be very organized, which is something, you know, with our breaks of chapters and verses, sometimes we miss that because the books themselves are putting in lines or repeated words and phrases that break up the book in its own way. So Moses, in the book of Genesis, he breaks up the book and he uses this little phrase, toledoth. So let's go to chapter 2, verse 4. I want you to just see this for yourself. So chapter 2, verse 4 says, these are the generations of the heavens and earth when they were created. Chapter 11, verse 27 says, now these are the generations of Terah, and it ends with Abraham. Well, this is a way, as he's telling his story, that he breaks it up into various sections, and you really need to read each section as its own unit. I mean, that's kind of his chapter breaks in a way. You can see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times he uses that in Genesis chapters 1 through 11. And Genesis chapters 1 through 11 are really the introduction for the whole Bible. I mean, you get Genesis 1:1 is the introduction to the book of Genesis. And Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, he hasn't said these are the generations. That's really the introduction to the rest of Genesis. Genesis is then the introduction to the whole Bible. It's the beginnings. as he introduces the generations, it draws our attention to the fact that, okay, he's trying to give us an account. He's accounting for the beginnings of those things. He's accounting for the beginnings of, as we look at that outline there, the beginnings of the heaven and the earth, the creation, and how we got the fall, the beginnings of Adam. And so we're following real broadly the whole heavens and the earth, the whole creation. And then he narrows down to Adam, and sin is spreading through his line. And then the story narrows down to Noah, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But we're going to look more specifically. We see what happens as sin spreads to all the nations of the earth, and then we're going to follow Shem's line. And then after that, those big sweeping introductions of many centuries, chapters 1 through 11, we land at Abraham. And then the story slows down a lot. We're going to cover a couple thousand years in chapters 1 through 11. And then we come to a screeching halt when we get to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Just a couple hundred years. God promises and commits himself not to destroy the earth with Noah and to bring his blessing back to all the peoples in the covenant with Abraham. And so even as we're reading, we cover so much ground in chapters 1 through 11, when he slows down like that, that's a way for Moses to say, okay, now we're getting into the story that we needed to talk about, which we'll be talking more about that next week. Let's look at, we're going to look at several verses in chapters 1 through 11, pulling a little bit out of each section there. Let's read Genesis 1, 1 through 5 together. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. What is the subject of the first sentence in the Bible? God. The creation account is first and foremost about God. Even from these opening verses, we learn a lot about who he is and who we are. So what do we learn about God as we read chapter 1 in Genesis? What do we learn about God? In the beginning, he already was. He is not part of the creation. He's outside the creation. He's eternal. The creation was created. It had a point in time beginning. God's outside of that. He's eternal. What else do we learn about God?
He's powerful.
He's powerful. He's sovereign. He wants to create something, and he creates it. Whatever God wills, he can do. And that's sovereignty. And power is part of that sovereignty, that he's capable of doing whatever he wants to do. And so he speaks, and it comes into existence.
What he does is good.
Yes, what he does is good. Seven times in Genesis chapter 1, he looks on what he made and he says it's good. A good God makes a good creation. Which is why when you read the Greeks' accounts of their gods and the Romans' gods, and even we were in Wendy's the other day getting a little frosty, and there's the advertisement for this TV show with Ted Danson. And it's a TV show, I guess, about what heaven's like. And it's filthy and lewd as any of our normal life here on earth. It looks just like the Greek gods and the Romans gods version of heaven. But the Bible starts with a good God, holy and righteous and pure, making a good creation, holy and righteous and pure. And one other thing that I would mention is God's self-sufficiency. He's not dependent on anything. There's nothing else that coexists with him. It is him. And then out of his self-sufficiency, he creates a creation that's dependent on him for its life and existence. This next section, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, through chapter 2, we have, it's a bit of a, we get more on the creation account, but it focuses on the creation of Adam and Eve. Mankind. Let's read Genesis 1, 26 through 28. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." What's the most significant thing about mankind that's not said about the other creatures or created things? There's something unique about man. He's created in God's image. Now, over the years, there have been a lot of things proposed. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? From the text here, the image of God seems to be very closely and most closely associated with Adam and Eve ruling over God's creation. Look at verse 26. "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion." Okay, and then verse 27, so God created man in his own image. And then verse 28, he said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and birds and the creatures." Being in the image of God, and this was very common in the ancient Near East, the Pharaoh of Egypt, the kings of the Hittites, they would refer to themselves as being in the image of God. Now, it wasn't used of all the commoners. It was used of the Pharaoh, and it was used of the king, that the God of the Egyptians has made me in his image in order to rule over this people. And so we see that same kind of language and idea reflected here, that all of mankind is made in God's image, And the purpose of God making them in his image was that they would rule and have dominion over the kingdom that he's created. Which is going to make Adam and Eve's rebellion all the more significant here in a minute. And of course, to be made in the image, it does include all of those things that we usually think of. We're made in the image of God. We're relational beings. We're rational beings. Those things are all true. But at least in Genesis 1, this idea of image is tied to the idea that we're supposed to rule on behalf of God. And you can think of image. We're the copy. Image in that day would have meant a statue, a carving. We're made in the image of God. We're not supposed to make images of God, according to the Ten Commandments. Make no graven image of God. God made his image. And it was man, it was Adam and Eve, living images of God, who were supposed to learn all of his ways, learn all of his wisdom, walk in righteousness, walk in truth, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. That's what it would be to live in God's image. They would rule over all of creation with the exact same justice, equity, and mercy and righteousness that God would rule over creation, right? That's what it means to be made in the image of God. Well, when Satan comes, he tempts them in chapter 3. And in chapter 3, verse 4, the serpent said to the woman, well, backing up, he says, did God actually say, you shall not eat of the tree of the garden? Verse 2, the woman said, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of that tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. But the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So what does this knowing good and evil mean? They're going to be like God somehow. And the way that they'll be like God is by knowing good and evil. Now, were Adam and Eve ignorant of good or evil? Did they have no conscience, no moral, no morality, no wisdom? No, they were thinking beings. They were rational beings. They had a conscience, just like we all have a conscience. They heard the voice of God. They received the commands of God. What does it mean that they will know good and evil? Well, in the Old Testament, this knowing good and evil can be taken in the sense of determining their own good and evil. Deciding what's good and evil, choosing what's good and evil. So later in the prophets, you're going to hear the prophets accusing the people of Israel. Rather than learning from God and following God's voice of what he calls good and what he calls evil, you're calling the evil good and you're calling the good evil. You're determining for yourselves what's good and evil. Rather than hearing from God and learning from God what's good and evil. And so here you have Adam and Eve taking this prerogative away from God, taking the prerogative for themselves to decide what's good and evil, to choose for themselves what's good and evil. And in doing so, I mean, God says on the day you eat of that fruit, you will surely die. Not because the fruit was bad, the fruit wasn't poisoned, but it's that you are going to so disrupt the relationship between me and you, and you are going to bring into yourselves sin, which is going to so corrupt and decay your soul, it's going to mean the end of you. And you're going to be under my judgment. You will die. I mean, we could talk about all the different senses in which bringing sin, committing that first sin, caused death. But know this, you will surely die. They're going to come under the judgment of God. They're going to break their relationship with God. It's going to mean the internal corruption of their mind and soul. As Romans 1 says, the darkening of their mind. And so they ate of that fruit in verse 7. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. They knew something was wrong. But what they didn't get what the serpent had promised. The serpent was deceiving them, thinking, you're going to be like God. You're going to be more exalted and more glorious than you were before. And of course, that's the deceit. They have become like God in that they have decided for themselves what's good and evil. But they didn't get any exaltation out of that. They don't get more glory. They don't get a better state of existence. Everything falls apart from that moment forward. Relationships begin to fall apart, and first and foremost with God. So they see, they recognize, they're naked. And the only reason they know or feel the shame of nakedness is because they feel the shame and the guilt of sin. Now I have to hide from you. Now I have to hide from God. The nakedness wasn't an issue before shame and guilt had come in and disrupted those relationships. But God promises in chapter 3, he pronounces his curse upon the woman, the curse upon the man, the curse upon the serpent. But he leaves them with a promise. Verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, but you shall bruise his heel. And there, this has been called the first gospel, the Latin phrase, the proto-euangelion. The first seedling of hope. God is promising that he's going to undo what's happened. This conflict that has come into place, that Satan has come and he's deceived Adam and Eve, he's disrupted the created order, he's disrupted their relationship with God. God says right here, I'm going to correct this. I'm going to undo this. I'm going to be victorious through the seed of the woman, through the offspring of the woman. She is going to be victorious over the offspring or the seed of the serpent. And so one of those beginnings that we learn when we're reading Genesis 1 through 11, we learn immediately, you and I are born into the middle of a war. We are born on the battlefield. There is a cosmic battle taking place between God and Satan, and it's over the creation. And Satan's already taken what was created good and taken the vice regents, the king and the queen, who were supposed to be under God's authority ruling over this. He's already convinced them to commit mutiny and treason, and they have fallen. We're born into that situation. We're born into that battle. And the story of the gospel is how God, in Jesus Christ, is going to be victorious over Satan, and he's going to reclaim mankind for himself. He's going to bring a people out of that treasonous people back to himself. In the next several chapters in the book of Genesis, You see that battle taking place. Cain is killing Abel. You see that even inside the nature of man, that battle's taking place. It's not just something external to us. Cain hates Abel. He kills him because he's righteous. The earth is filled with wickedness. And so God says, I'm going to make a new start. I'm going to wipe out mankind. He's grieved over the evil, the wickedness that fills the earth. And so he chooses Noah. And Noah is a testimony to the presence of God, to the authority of God. And I think that if anyone had said, had come to Moses, had come to Noah and said, we believe what you're telling us. We believe God is angry with all creation because of our wickedness. How can we be saved? I think that they would have entered the ark with Moses. Sorry, I keep saying Moses here. They would have entered the ark with Noah and been saved. But we see they mock Noah. They think he's a fool. But we also see once Noah and his family are saved after the flood, sin is still in the heart of man. It hasn't happened. Nothing has happened to change that fact. And so then with Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, his sons, they multiply, they fill the earth. Mankind begins building a tower in the name of man for the glory of man. And what does God do? He comes and confuses their languages so that they're split up into different nations, into different families. And so we have the beginnings of all the nations of the earth. And it's with that divided nations that the introduction to Genesis and the rest of Scripture ends. And it's not going to be until Christ that all of those nations are drawn back together into one people under the authority of God and under the blessing of God. But we'll start more with that next week. So let's take a break before the worship service.